Hi, it's Radhika Jones, Editor-in-Chief of Vanity Fair. If you love digging into the week's political headlines, subscribe to Vanity Fair. Our reporters take you behind the scenes of some of the biggest stories from the campaign trail to the halls of Congress. Just for our Inside the Hive listeners, save 15% on a yearly digital subscription to Vanity Fair with promo code POD15. That's vanityfair.com, promo code POD15, for 15% off 1 year of all you can read, watch, and hear.
John Kelly, are you there?
Hey, Nick. Here I am.
Hi, everyone. It's your host, Nick Bilton, and we are on Inside the Hive. I decided this week, you know what? I'm so sick of Donald Trump. We're going to go talk about something way more fun and maybe even richer. I went to Silicon Valley and spent time with someone who's been doing this for a long, long time in the tech world. And before I tell you who it is, I want to ask you a question. If you started a little startup in a coffee shop one day, and a couple of years later, Facebook came along and said, hey, you know what? Your startup's pretty cool. I want to offer you $100 million for it. What would you say?
Yes.
Okay.
yes, that's and it. Followed by now.
Well, the person that I sat down with this week, Dennis Crowley, who started Foursquare, also a company called Dodgeball, which he sold to Google many years earlier, not for $100 million, had that exact encounter with Facebook and Yahoo, and I almost called them Yoohoo there, and then also had an opportunity years later to sell the company for a lot more in the $500 million range and turned it down. And I just wanted to go talk to him about what it was like to start a company like that and see it go to where it went today.
Well, even though I would have definitely taken both of those offers, Nick, and I suspect that you might have entertained them for a second or two yourself, I have a lot of respect for these entrepreneurs, and Evan Spiegel's a good example of a modern one, who do not fold when Facebook and other behemoths come knocking on their door, that they seem to recognize that what they have in both their product roadmap and also their sort of abiding vision for the operation is more valuable under their control than it would be in the hands of an oligarchic company. Good for Dennis Crowley. It's a sort of unfathomable question for most people, but if you are a legit straight up Silicon Valley nerd, who believes in what you're doing, then owning the direction of your company is often as important as the money involved.
Well, let's get started. I had a really fascinating conversation with him. We talked about building startups, what it's like when you kind of have a bunch of money and you feel lost, how he decided not to sell Foursquare. He now owns a small soccer team in addition to being on the board at Foursquare. And we got into one of my favorite questions: why are so many people in Silicon Valley assholes? So let's jump right in. So I am here at the Foursquare offices in San Francisco, California, with Dennis Crowley, who I've known for how long have I known you, Dennis?
Probably 10 years, right?
Maybe a little more.
Yeah.
Maybe 701 years. Just for the people listening, because I know you can't see, this is like one of those, if you imagine a San Francisco, New York startup with, free snacks and sodas and sriracha hot sauce on the tables and lots of big screens that look really cool. That's where we are right now. So Dennis was, you want to do the intro? Let's have you do the intro.
Sure. Well, my name is Dennis Crowley. I'm the co-founder and executive chair of Foursquare. Yep. Foursquare is a location intelligence company. We build tools and software that enable all sorts of different companies to be able to do interesting things with location technology.
Wait, I'm just going to interrupt you for a second. If you can hear the traffic outside, I apologize, but just think of it as like you're in the room with us. Sorry, keep going, Dennis.
We started Foursquare in 2009. Company, did I already say this? Company's about 250 people. We have a handful of offices kind of scattered throughout the world. I've been doing kind of location technology work, I think, almost my whole career. I had a company before this that was called Dodgeball, which is our grad
school.
So
I'm actually going to interrupt you, and we're going to go back to Dodgeball.
Yeah.
So Dodgeball sold to Google in what, 2000?
2005.
2005. And you were how old, 12?
I think I was it was just before my 27th birthday.
Okay, so just before your 27th birthday.
Is that right? Maybe. I'd have to do the math.
Let's just pretend 27.
Okay.
26, you're 26. So one of the things that's so interesting is I think a lot of people, this is not a lot of people that sell a company, and never mind the one that they sell to Google. What is that process like? You came up with this thing, this you know, you can give us 140 character or 280 character since we're now in that world version of what it was. But does someone just like knock on your door and they say, "Hey, I want to buy your company. Here's a bag full of money." Like, how does it work?
I wish it was that easy. We were students at we were grad students at NYU at this program called ITP, and we were just making weird stuff for phones. We had this kind of thesis that like, we could make software that made cities easier to use, which is kind of a radical idea at the time. And the way that we would do that is we would put software on cell phones.
These are old cell phones.
This is a flip phone. No web browser. No color screen. No apps. No GPS. But I was reading the Harry Potter books at the time. And the idea of the Marauder's Map, like Harry Potter has this map and you can see where all your friends are. It's like, well, that'd be cool if we had that in New York. How would you even make the scrappiest version of that? And we said, well, we'll just do it with text messages. So people would broadcast a location. Hey, I'm at the library. Hey, I'm at a bar called The Magician. And everyone would get those text messages. And this is in a time when not a lot of people got text messages, especially text messages from software. And so if you got one of those messages, you would drop whatever you were doing and you'd run to the bar to go meet your friends. It's just kind of the way that it worked. And so we built this thing, which was super weird and quirky, and it worked really well in New York. And many people said, like, no one will ever want that or pay for it. There's no business there. And so we just kept plugging away at it as grad students. I remember, like, we didn't know how to raise venture capital. It wasn't a lot of VC firms in New York. We didn't have access to those people. But, I spoke at a conference out in San Francisco once, and I think NYU paid my way out to go there. And while we were speaking, we caught the attention of some folks that worked at Google. And, eventually that led to being invited to the Google office in San Francisco back in, 2004, super, super early, pre-IPO. And going there and explaining our thesis project and explaining the stuff that we were really excited about to them, which was awesome. That's like the best audience you could have. And after a bunch of those conversations, it came down to like, hey, Google doesn't really invest in companies, but if you guys are really passionate about building this type of stuff, you should just come here. Like, how about we just buy your company and you can come and work at Google?
So that's it. They're like, we'll just buy it.
Yeah, at the time, me and my co-founder Alex, we were trying to figure out what should we do in New York to pay our rent later this summer? Should I go get a job at MTV? Should I go try to work at an ad agency and be the internet guy there? Like, so this was like the best thing you could possibly imagine, because it's a scenario in which wait, you're gonna pay us a bunch of money to come to your company to eat all the free food that everyone knows Google for, and to work on the project that we love working on. Like, this is a great deal. 100% we will do this.
And so then what was the next step? They bought the company, they paid you money, and then you just went over there? Or?
Yeah, it was like, it wasn't a high priority for them. It's like, it wasn't a huge dollar transaction. And so, it took a long time. It took, I want to say it took like 6 or 7 months for us to have like a full discussion about like, should we come here? Like, where will we work? Who will be our manager? What will we do? We'll work in the New York office.
So how does it work when, and I know this was not a huge, this wasn't $100 million acquisition, but it was a few million bucks. And is it literally like you look at your ATM one day and you're like, oh, I have $4. And then the next day you're like, oh, I have seven digits in there? Like, or is there like a system that they pay you in a certain amount and then you get all the stock and you have to wait, or the vest? Like, how does it, how did it work?
Generally, it's like there's some cash component.
Yeah.
In which we got like one lump sum of cash, and I remember going to the ATM and like, I'm going to print out five ATM receipts and save them so I remember how awesome this was. And then, you know, some of it is tied to an earn out. Like if you, you know, accomplish these things at the company, like you unlock additional cash, and some of it is in Google stock. So we were, you know, we got Google stock. We joined right, you know, not too long after the IPO, and we vested on a schedule just like everyone else would vest.
And did you ever meet Larry and Sergey?
Yeah, not so much during like the acquisition process. Like we were just a 2-person company, so not super high priority.
Yeah.
And you know, now they call them acquihires, right? Mm-hmm. Instead of acquisitions. I think we were the company that when we got picked up by Google, someone coined the term acquihire. But you know, like in the first couple months that we were in Google New York, I remember Sergey rollerblading into our little cubicle office and poking his head in and saying like, "Hey, you guys are the snowball guys, right?" And I was like, "We're the dodgeball team." And he's like, "Oh yeah, that's great. Keep doing great work." And then he skated off.
That was the last you ever saw of him?
No, I've seen him a bunch of times since then. But it's like a funny first meeting for, you know, a mythical character, right?
Yeah,
this is the guy that invented Google, and here he is on his rollerblades in our office. Like that's a cool story.
It's funny when you hear these stories and you think about the TV show Silicon Valley. It is pretty accurate, pretty accurate portrayal. So okay, so you sold your company. How long did you stick around at Google for?
We were there for about 2 years.
And then did you retire, like mini retire? Like what happened next?
No, I mean we had really ambitious plans for like the types of things that you could do with Dodgeball and with like kind of the information and the data that the product was generating. But we never, I don't think Google was set up at the time for us to really be able to pursue a lot of those things. It just wasn't like on Google's roadmap. So like when we left, we were pretty like upset and disappointed. Like this is this project that we really, really cared about. We were very passionate about, and we went there to build this thing and get help in building it. But we couldn't build the things that we wanted to. So it was like a sad day leaving, just because we left the project behind. Like they had acquired it. Like that was my only email address, Dens at Dodgeball, and I left that email address behind, and I wasn't able to access it. You know, this community of users that loved what we were doing and loved the kind of, you know, R&D approach we had to just building stuff and launching it for the hell of it. Like we had to leave all that behind, and so I left, and you know, I ended up working at some friends had like a game design shop called Area Code, and I worked there for, you know, like 8 months or so, just trying to get myself back into something. And I had a hard time falling in love with some of those projects. And, you know, it was probably about 2 years after we, not 2 years, about 18 months after we left Google, where, you know, they had made an announcement that they were going to turn Dodgeball off and they just weren't going to support it anymore. And then that was like this kind of cathartic moment where it's like, if they really don't want it, like, let's just build another one. We'll build a better one. Like, we'll take everything that we wanted to do and we'll do it now that, like, things like the iPhone exist. And now that people understand how to use things like, you know, like Facebook.
And that was the beginning of Foursquare.
Yeah. Yeah. That was us getting, it was like January 2009 where we really sat down and said, okay, let's get serious about this and let's make something.
So one of the things that's really interesting, just to get back to before we get to Foursquare and what you're doing now and everything, and I want to hear some good stories of like fundraising and all those fun things. But before we get to that, one of the things a lot of people think is they look at people that have been successful in Silicon Valley, and I say Silicon Valley just in terms of the tech industry itself, and they think, oh, well, they sold their company for a bunch of money. Why aren't they sitting on a beach or you know, mountainside or something like that. And the thing that from people I have spoken to over the years that I always get the impression is that it's not about the money. It's about the building the thing. You went through something like that, right? You left Google, you were like a ski bum for 6 months or something. Is that right? Or,
I took another job right after that.
Yeah.
Right? And, you know, just to like, I have to be doing something. And, you know, I was there for, I don't know, six or seven months. And then after that, I was just like, I'm just going to take some time off. Like, I traveled for, you know, went around Scandinavia with my college roommate for like 30 days. I did a summer share out in Montauk, and I surfed like a whole bunch of days, and I just was kind of aimless. But I was kind of depressed, to be honest, because like I wasn't doing anything, and I had all these things that I wanted to build and all these ideas that we didn't get to fulfill with Dodgeball. And it was like, what am I doing just kind of sitting here? It sounds glamorous, but it's not if you've got all this stuff you want to do.
Do you think that, because I've heard other people in tech that have sold their companies and have been through that same thing, this like this aimlessness and this like depressed almost. And do you think that is something that is just the like tied to people like you with your personality that are building things? Or do you think that anyone put in that situation where they didn't have to work in that moment in time would feel the same way?
I think people get energy from doing different things, and some people like get it. Some people might get it from like consuming media or creating media, reading books, like watching movies and things. Like I get energy from creating things, and I think I'm still trying to figure this all out for myself. But I think it's about like building things that bring people together and bring, you know, building things that people get enjoyment out of, like users and communities and stuff. And in the absence of doing that type of creation, I get really like itchy, you know. I get really dissatisfied and really restless. And it took me a while to kind of self-diagnose it as like, I think I was just depressed during that time, you know. And I remember having my buddies, you know, come over, and they could tell I wasn't like myself because I wasn't working on a project, and being like, don't worry, someday you'll find something that you want to work on again. Like, we know you will. Like, trying to, you know, give me a pep talk. And that was, you know, that's like 3 months before the Foursquare journey started.
So, okay, so let's move forward to Foursquare. I remember I actually was in New York at the time, and we had become friends. And there was a coffee shop over by NYU, and I would see you and your co-founder, Naveen, in the coffee shop. I think I was writing a book at the time. I forget what I was doing.
As one does.
Or yeah. Just looking at porn in a coffee shop. I don't know. But but I remember sitting next to you guys, and it was just you two. It was just the two of you building this thing. And you created all these, you know, gaming incentives and mayorships and things like that. And then next thing you know, it almost seems like a flash flood, but Foursquare was the thing that all anyone could talk about. Facebook was terrified of it. Twitter was worried about it. It was the thing, and location-based services were the thing. And, you know, you were on the cover of Wired with a crown on.
Unfortunately, a true story. Yeah.
Yeah. What is that like, being the like center of that little universe for a minute? What is that experience like? What do people, are they just trying to be your friend so they can get money into your company to make money? Is it like, what's going on?
Yeah, it was rather overwhelming. I think that was, you know, that was our lives for like 2 years, where you had like everyone wanted to work at the company, and everyone wanted to do a partnership with the company, and everyone wanted to put money into the company. And, you know, you just end up at, you know, interesting dinners with interesting people. And, you know, it was incredibly overwhelming. And what's interesting is that, like, that it's so funny that, like, that's the way that you remember the story of, like, you know, Foursquare at launch, and it was just, like, the hottest thing around, right? But, like, you know, we started Foursquare January 2009. We launched it at South by Southwest in March of 2009. About 5,000 people cared about it, and then we went out to try to raise money off that. And for 6 months, you know, I had 32, 33 people said, no, this is an awful idea. We will never invest in this. Why are you doing this? You're wasting your time. You already did this thing. Google didn't want it. And we just kept working on it. And it wasn't until, you know, really like August of 2009 that, you know, that there was some, that there started to become some interest in what we were doing. And once there was some interest, and one of the first VC firms to really show interest was Union Square Ventures in New York, and once they decided they were interested, it was like this big switch, and then everyone was interested, and then when everyone was interested, it was entirely unmanageable, because you go from like making a whole bunch of phone calls hoping someone will call you back to your phone just ringing all the time with people trying to do nice things for you so that you will choose them, you know, for your financing.
So what kind of things did people try to do to, you know, what nice things happened?
We would, you know, like we, there's just a lot of like whining and dining and stuff. Now, I think it, like we were, if I had not gone through like the humbling experience that was Dodgeball, which was having this thing that I loved and then it, you know, it not working out and then going through this like weird depression phase and then having to resurrect the idea as Foursquare. I think if I had not gone through that humbling experience, I probably would have turned into like a huge asshole during the.
Well, you're kind of an asshole.
I think I'm working on it. Yeah, but it's like it's crazy.
No, I can see it. I see it happen to assholes all the time.
Yeah, and so I'm very thankful that we lived through that experience because I think it helped us figure out like, hey, we have something special here. Like, let's be slow and steady and cautious so that we don't screw it up, right? And because this is like what we have is special and important, and we need to make sure that we, you know, put the pieces together in a way that will work for us in the long term.
And so I remember back then you coming out to San Francisco to raise money, and you had like all these funny stories of like this was like I think Teslas weren't even out yet, and you had tweeted how much you would like to drive a Tesla, and didn't someone like take you to the Tesla track? Like what?
Well, we were on Sand Hill Road, and you know, just seeing as many people as we could possibly see for fundraising.
And is it like playing Monopoly where you're just like, oh, I'm going to go here, and then you go to the next building, and just meet with all these people?
Kind of. You're just kind of scheduling things on the fly. And I remember I probably tweeted something out about like, oh, it'd be so cool to drive that around, and then like the dealership tweets you back and say, hey, why don't you stop by in between meetings? And so we did that, and we did a lap around Sand Hill Road in between meetings. And I think, you know, we were late to our meeting with Twitter because we were screwing around with the Tesla on Sand Hill Road. You know, and I remember Business Insider wrote a story about it, and it was like, you know, the fabulous life of what it's like to be fundraising as the CEO of Foursquare, which you go back and you look at now, it's like, oh my God, this is just like out of control. but it was just nuts. You know, it was just a very, very busy time where you're trying to build the company. You're trying to build, like literally build the product, like build the code and then build the company, hire these people and then, you know, get a good culture working so that everyone's psyched about what they're doing and then do all the external evangelism and then travel around and do the financing. It's just a lot.
So, I've been writing about this stuff for a long time and have always found this fascinating about valuations. But I want to hear it from you as someone who went through it. When you first got, you're out here at that point in time, are you raising your first round, your A round of funding?
We came out here for the A, but we ended up doing the A with O'Reilly and Union Square. It was the B that we were like, we want to do something with someone in San Francisco.
So you came out for the B. So with the A round, what were you valued at the time? Like 5-10 million?
Yeah, it was 5-7.
But for the
maybe.
B round, the number went up dramatically.
Yeah,
right?
It might have gone up to like 20 or so.
And so how? So you go to the B round.
Is that right? I have to go back and. It's telling that I can't remember it. Yeah.
But at the time, of course, that's all anyone cared about. So you come out here and you're on Sand Hill Road and you're going for rides in Teslas and you're going to billionaires' houses for dinners and they're giving you free slippers and things like that. You should tell that story at some point.
Hold on. The B is at it's a $20 million raise at $100 million valuation.
Okay, it was a $20 million raise at $100 million valuation. How do you get to that $100 million number? Like when you go in, you have no revenue. You have how many employees back then? A few dozen, maybe.
Yeah, 20 or so. Yeah.
You're in a little office in downtown New York City. Like, how do you come up with that number?
We don't come up with it. People come up with it for us.
But
right?
where does it come from?
Well, at that time, you know, around at South by Southwest 2010, when we were like the hottest thing you could imagine, And remember, this is a time where there's just not a ton of startups. You know, if you launch something, you were the story on TechCrunch for 30 days in a row, because there just wasn't a ton of stuff to write about. Yahoo expressed interest in buying the company, and I think they were the ones that came out with the number was around $100 million.
That's what they wanted to buy it for?
Yeah, and we're like, holy cow! Like that, why would you not do that?
And so why did you not do that?
Well, then it was, you know, Facebook was interested, and then it was VCs were interested in putting money into the company at that valuation. And this was a really, really hard decision to make, because if you were driven just by the fact that you wanted to have a financial exit, like, you would 100% take the money, because why would you not? But like, we had sold the thing to Google before, and we had made a little bit of, you know, we've made money off of that, and I had realized that like, the money ultimately wasn't the thing that made me happy, and the thing that made me happy was building things. And I was like, we have the opportunity to build something great, and it appears as if everyone in the world is looking at us as if we have the opportunity to build something great. So why would we give this up? Like, let's go and build this. And I knew that like, if we had said yes to that, and if we had sold the company, there's a good chance we would have regretted it later on for having this awesome moment in time and not have seen it all the way through.
So when Yahoo approached you to try to buy the company, did they just knock on your door and say, we really want this, this is what we're willing to offer?
We had a meeting with them at South by Southwest, like 2010. I remember it just like, we were coming off a crazy week of like everyone using the product, everyone kind of speculating about what we would be able to do
I remember I was at the New York Times. And Jenna Wortham did a big story on you guys. We're on the front page of the business section. It was,
it was super, it just really, really crazy time. But it was a, like, I can't stress how hard of a decision it was to say like, no, we're not going to do this. We're not going to sell the company. We're going to take another round of financing, and we're going to just build something awesome.
And so you tell Yahoo no, then Facebook comes knocking at your door, and you get the Mark Zuckerberg experience. What was that like?
Mark is
a incredibly intense human being who could probably convince me to...
Mark was super, super helpful. And I remember, like, I went to Facebook and I met with him. We had lunch in the cafeteria. And, you know, he's like, hey, if you want to sell the company, like, you should come, you should sell it to Facebook, because, like, we're interested and excited about this stuff. And if you don't, like, here's 10 pieces of advice for how to go forward. And I thought that was just, like, super, like, it was super generous for him to spend time and kind of share a lot of that advice. And then just, like, it's, like, a classy thing to do.
What was his advice?
I'll tell you, the best piece of advice, which I've given to 100 people since then, is, like, Mark said, if you want to, you know, if you're going to continue, you know, being the CEO, you got to figure out what kind of CEO you want to be. And you can either be the product CEO, you can be the sales CEO, you can be the evangelist CEO, you can be the operations CEO, you can be the engineering CEO. You have to pick one of those types and just do that job really well and delegate the rest of the responsibilities to someone else. And like, I remember clear as day sitting down with him in like 2010 having that conversation, and I was like, that's the only way to keep sane in doing this job, and that's what... Like, that's what we did.
So which CEO did you become?
I was product CEO. Hired a COO, hired a chief revenue person, you know, started building a really strong engineering organization. Like, just that idea of you can be whatever type of CEO you want to be, but just pick the one that you want to be and do it really well, and just make sure you're very clear in delegating everything else to the rest of your team.
So you... you decided to take the $20 million with a $100 million valuation. I'm going to jump forward and jump back for a second. There was a point when Foursquare was worth $1 billion.
No, we never got that.
Close to $1 billion.
We were north of $500 million, yeah.
North of five. So, and then it kind of went back down a little bit. And do you, looking back, regret the decision you made or no?
No. I have no regrets about that, because I think this is this job has been, and this experience has been the hardest thing I've ever done. And I feel like I've made lots of sacrifices with, like, you know, my life and personal experiences in general to be able to do it. But it's been like a huge privilege to do it. It's like the best ride you could ever be on. You know, we built this huge company. There's been like 1,000 people that have worked at Foursquare at any given time. There's like a whole like Foursquare mafia that's gone on to do all these great things. And like we've inspired other entrepreneurs to like to go forward with the things that they want to do. Like I remember it being like a real conversation, like around the time that we had turned down some of the offers, like, you know, being able to really express to people, like, the point of this is not to build something and just sell it to the first big company that comes asking. The point is to build something great and to be part of the ecosystem and be one of those companies that gets to contribute to, you know, like the legacy of awesome, you know, tech and products that have been built over the course, you know, of the last 20 or 50 years. And if you, I really believe if you sell the company and if you let go of it too early, you don't get to be a part of that. And, you know, at this point, 10 years through, like, it's very easy for me to articulate the, you know, the contributions that we've made and the good things that have come out of the company. And, you know, you can kind of Monday morning quarterback and be like, well, would we have done more? Would we have done bigger if we were part of another company early on? And I don't see how that could have been the case.
You're listening to Inside the Hive with Nick Bilton.
John, this is a fascinating interview so far, but I want to take a moment to talk about one of our sponsors, Goop. I hear you have been using Goop lately.
I love Goop, and Goop loves me.
I think it's a really cool brand. I was actually out at the Goop store this week, which was really fun. They have lots of fascinating stuff. But did I hear that you've been buying Rebecca, your wife, some stuff, and she's been super duper into all this?
Loves drinkable, single serving skin supporter with the whole inside out nutrition. It gives her a healthy complexion, you know, with all these powerful antioxidants, vitamin C, E, and more good stuff that I'm not even scientific enough to know. She loves it. I love it. I love doing it for her. It tastes delicious too. The orange, the lemon for being, I mean, I can go on for days.
The Goop Glow Morning Skin Super Powder actually does taste really delicious. I've been stealing them from Krista. Well, anyway, I think it's a fantastic brand. They have great stuff. Their newsletter is really fun. It comes out twice a week. It talks about travel and food and beauty and style and work and, of course, wellness. They have this app that I downloaded recently, which will tell you like the greatest places in and around you that also offer those kinds of things. One thing that they're doing this week is that Hive listeners will get a lots of cool options that they can buy off the website. All they have to do is go to goop.com/hive. It's a special page just for Hive listeners. It's called goop.com/hive. That's goop.com/hive. So fast forward now a little bit. The company continues to raise money and grow, and you've got, you know, tens of millions of users. And then you kind of started to run into some bumps.
Yeah.
What was that like, and what happened?
Yeah, the trickiest thing, I guess, like in the whole Foursquare story is that, you know, we were a consumer app that people use to like check in and you know earn points and badges and discounts, and there's a city guide. Is everything kind of lumped into one? And you know, we were valued as a consumer app that continues to grow, because like the other comps that were out there, it's like, okay, well, Facebook is growing really quickly, Twitter's growing quickly, Foursquare is going to be the next Twitter. But we just hit a point where we just stopped growing, you know, around like 30, 40 million users. You know, we just don't have that same type of growth. And we didn't have it because like things like Instagram are coming on the scene. Facebook decided to do a check-in button. Google was, you know, starting to take some of our elements and copy it into Google Maps. Like Zagat got really aggressive with trying to, you know, I guess, cribbing off some of the things that we were doing. And so it kind of plateaued the growth. And if you're not growing, then you don't have a greater audience to sell ads to. And then it's like, well, what's the plan? And so, you know, like the big moment for the company was realizing like, hey, like this thing, if it's going to continue and continue to be successful, it can't just be a consumer apps advertising based company. Like we have to be able to monetize the insights that we're getting from the data, like where all the devices are going, where are all these phones going in aggregate. And, you know, we had a moment where all these people that were using our API to build great things, but they weren't paying us for using the API. And I remember it came up at a board meeting, and you know, I think it was like Ben Horowitz from Andreessen Horowitz was like, it is absolutely crazy that you guys aren't charging people for the API. These companies need the service that you provide. And I remember being like, I don't think we can charge them because they'll just switch to something else. And you know, Ben was like, well, we have to try because we have to figure out a model that's around like data and technology licensing. And so that's what we went out and did. And sure enough, like it turns out that lots of companies wanted to pay us for the privilege of either licensing the data or licensing the technology.
And so now you're more less of a consumer checking company and more of a data company, a data analytics company?
Yeah, we have two consumer apps. There's an audience of about 50 million people that use them, which is great. You know, there's one app called the Foursquare City Guide, which is like a super smart personalized version of Yelp. And then there's the Swarm app, which people use to check in. And, you know, there's a team that works on both of those, and we're very proud of both of the apps. But the apps generate lots of data about like where do people go and where do people used to go and where do people go now and what's great about those places. And so what we do is we package up lots of the data that we have, and you know, we help companies make sense out of like this type of like foot traffic trends. Where are people going? Where do they used to be going? Which stores are hot? Which stores are not? How are your stores doing versus the other stores? Like that stuff is really valuable to a lot of retailers.
And didn't you, I remember you had a huge, there was a moment where I was like, I saw kind of this holy shit moment when you predicted what would happen with Chipotle.
Yeah, we did.
Can you tell that story?
Yeah, the two big examples were number one, could we, you know, when I think it was like the iPhone 5 or 6, maybe the iPhone 6. iPhone 6 came out. You know, Apple never tells you how many units they sell. It's like, we're going to make a prediction on how many they're going to sell by measuring the number of phones that go in and out of the stores, and then to normalize that data and make a prediction on it. And, you know, we did so this a couple years ago. And, you know, we were kind of right on the money. I remember that moment where a lot of people kind of turned their heads and looked at us like, wait, who is this company, Foursquare? Like this social app that's now making predictions about, like, you know, foot traffic trends and sales patterns. And then it was like, well, do it again. If it works so well, do it again. And then it was, you know, like 6 months later, it was the Chipotle, you know, E. coli scare, right? So, like, you know, the Wall Street is waiting, like, how much of the earnings is going to be down based on the fact that people weren't eating there last quarter? It's like, well, why don't we make a prediction? Because we know, based on how many phones are going in and out of the Chipotles. And we made a prediction, and we nailed it as well.
And it was then, like 30%, and then they literally said,
yeah, we were like 29.7%, right? And the real interesting story behind this is, like, there was, you know, there's some people at Foursquare that came up to me and said, hey, I have this idea for we could be able to make these types of predictions with our data. And they pitched it to me, and I was CEO at the time. And I was like, I don't know if this is what we're supposed to be doing. Like, that seems like it's someone else's business. But I'm like, if you feel really passionate about it, like, go model it out. Go see what it is. And then let's look at it as, like, an executive team, and we'll look at it with the PR people, and we'll decide if we want to do that. And, like, you know, that's, you know, someone else's idea that comes to the leader, the CEO, with a crazy idea. And instead of shutting it down, it's like, let's try it. Let's go ahead with it. And, you know, the history of Foursquare, the company, is full of, like, people having these kind of oddball ideas and us rolling the dice with them.
Well, isn't that the history of Silicon Valley?
I think so, yeah. But it's like, I've certainly worked at places where I've brought up the oddball ideas, and people are like, that's stupid. We're definitely not going to do that. And it's like, well, why wouldn't we at least try it, right? And so, you know, when we built Foursquare the company, we built it with, like, okay, anyone, if they're an intern or, like, a VP, can come to one of the executives and pitch their crazy idea, and we will listen to it, right? And that was, you know, like, that, trying to build a culture like that and trying to, like, stay true to that was directly related to, like, our previous experiences working at jobs where that type of feedback wasn't welcome.
So today, there's a lot of talk about artificial intelligence and big data and, you know, and being able to predict things. And, you know, one theory that we're hearing a lot is that companies like Amazon, for example, will know when you need diapers for your kid, and they will just drop them off at your doorstep. They just bought Ring this week, and maybe they'll just be able to open the door and put them in, put them away. In. Maybe they will just take the baby and bring it back with a new diaper on.
I would subscribe to that service.
Me too, actually, especially at 6 in the morning. What do you think that we're going to, like, all this data that we have, do you think that we are going to get to that point where companies start to predict things and we as consumers no longer have to think about them? And is that a good thing or a bad thing?
Well, we're kind of already there, right? Doesn't Netflix tell you what show to watch next? And doesn't Spotify tell you which playlist to listen to tomorrow?
But I think that those are with digital things, not necessarily... Digital experience is not necessarily which restaurant I should go to and when and so on.
I mean, this
is
like a core part of Foursquare's DNA, right? Can we make a piece of software that points you towards something that you never would have done otherwise, you had no intention of doing, but you loved it anyway? And, you know, that was part of the thinking in 2009, and we're still kind of scratching the itch of solving that problem. But, yeah, I definitely believe in that stuff. You know, I don't think it's, we've gone as far to prototype things where it's like you could, you know, if you blocked off a night on your calendar and let Foursquare know about, I blocked off this Tuesday night slot. Go book me some surprise restaurant that I'll love. Find an open table and I'll go there. Like, could we build stuff like that? And then, you know, and...
Would you order for me too?
And, well, I mean, that's one of the things that we try to do, right? If you have Foursquare on your phone and you walk into a restaurant, there's a good chance you will get a notification that's like, hey, while you're here, you need to order, you know, this appetizer, this entree and this dessert.
I actually do follow it, and it's always right.
It's awesome, right?
It's always right.
Yeah, so it's like, really can you hit the person? And that's a very hard technical problem to solve. Like, identify the place the user's at, see if it's an interesting place for them, try to figure out what on the menu they would like, and then hit them with that message before they make the decision on their own. But that's like, if you could do that and make it work really, really well, like that, those are magical experiences for people.
So you mentioned earlier that if you hadn't have gone through the dodgeball experience of selling your company and realizing that that wasn't the right decision to make, that you would have ended up being an asshole. And one of the things about Silicon Valley is there are a lot of assholes. There are a lot of CEOs that are douchebags that, you know, don't necessarily care about the consumer or their employees or the society or the technology and how it impacts them and so on. Why do you think that there are so few people? I mean, if you ask me to list people that run companies out here that are good people, the list is going to fit on my hand, honestly. Why do you think that that is the case?
I think it's, you know, we've lived through the experience. I've lived through the experience of scaling the company from like 2 people to 250 people. And, you know, that we've done that over 10 years. That's a 250 person company is a big company. But, you know, by comparison's sake out here, by a lot of the big tech companies in San Francisco, it's relatively small. We don't have thousands of employees. And I think we found it is very chaotic to scale a company from 20 to 50 to 100 people. We've been fortunate that we've been, you know, between 175 and 200, 250 people for a while. Like, we operate at this scale really, really well. And I think it makes it easier for us to focus on the things that are important to us, which is, you know, let's make sure that we're treating everyone's privacy with respect. Let's make sure that we build apps that surprise and delight people. Let's make sure that we build technology that inspires another generation of entrepreneurs, right? And that's the stuff that's important to us.
And these bigger companies are just going so quickly and are so worried about competition that they don't necessarily think those things through? Or?
Maybe, or it's like the pressure to get as big as you possibly can. You know, like, we lived through that moment of getting as big as you possibly can, and it was chaotic and not like, I mean, it's like a whirlwind, but it's not necessarily a ton of fun. You know, when I think, like, we're at the stage now where we're scaling a business that works, which is, I think it's a different journey than just, like, get as big as you can as quickly as possible.
So you've had the opportunity to work with a lot of big VCs and you know, you had that great advice from Zuckerberg. Like, what's some of the best advice that you've gotten from some of these folks?
That's a great question. You know, you get different types of investors give you different types of advice. A lot of it's very operational. Like, you know, we have an amazing board of directors, and the best part about them is like they're like, you know, they call them high quality investors, which means like they have sat on the boards of other high quality companies, and they've seen like high class problems, and they understand how to solve those problems, right? By sitting in the boardroom of a Facebook or Twitter or Tumblr or Etsy or Salesforce or whatever, you know, you get a sense of like, okay, these are the problems that companies have, and here's a menu of ways that you would be able to deal with those problems. Hey, executive team at Foursquare, here's, you know, how are you going to do it? Here's a menu of solutions. Which one are you going to choose? It's just really, really helpful to have that. You know, overall, I'll tell you, the two best pieces of advice have come from my parents, right? And my mom telling me, like, when we were working on, we wanted to work on the dodgeball stuff, and everyone was telling us it was a stupid idea. She's just like, you should just do the thing that you love, and the rest of it stuff will just figure it out. Which is, it sounds like the cheesiest, like corniest advice, but it's like permission to go work on the wild thing, that crazy thing that just is personally interesting. And, you know, if you do that for long enough, there's a good chance that other things will just happen around it. And that has been true for every single project I've ever worked on, including the soccer stuff, right? The second stuff is, you know, my dad in the early days of Foursquare, when we were getting so much press all the time, I remember him being like, you know, Den, you can't eat newspapers. Meaning like you're getting lots of attention about what you're doing, but eventually you got to figure out a way to monetize this thing so that like it starts to make sense to the rest of the outside world. And I've used that quote a lot
you
with
can't
folks
eat
internally.
Newspapers?
Yeah,
I love that.
You can't eat newspapers.
All right, so let's. I want to get to what you're doing now, but let's get to what happened next. So you know, the company stopped growing, and eventually you decided to, or did you decide to step down as CEO, or was it one of those like, I'm going to go spend time with my family?
No. This is directly related to you, right? When we were building and scaling Foursquare, around the time that we figured out, like, this is going to be more of an enterprise data business than it's going to be a consumer business. Now, remember, I had chosen to be the consumer product CEO off of, you know, Mark's advice, and that is how I structured my role, and that's how I structured my time. And that's personally what I'm interested in doing. And so, you know, there was a moment where it's like, listen, if we're really going to be successful, we need to get a different type of leader in here. You need someone that wakes up every morning so excited about sales teams and enterprise data and, you know, just building that type of business. And, you know, I think I told you this story. I was reading your book, Hatching Twitter, about the moment that, you know, Twitter had a conversation with Ev, who was the CEO at the time, about the leadership change. And, you know, there was an unexpected meeting put on my calendar at one point where two of our board members were in our New York office.
While you were reading this book?
I was reading the book being like, oh, I know what happens when these unexpected meetings show up. I'm going to walk into work and get fired, right? Because I was like, they're going to fire me because that's the direction the company needs to go in. And, of course, I went into this meeting, and it was with Albert Wagner from Union Square and Ben Horowitz from Andreessen Horowitz, two of our investors.
Were you petrified that you were going to get...
Yeah, I was like, oh my God, I'm going to get fired today. What is it like to get fired? I haven't been fired in a long time, but I'm going to learn. I'm going to figure it out today. And so I sat down at the boardroom that we have in the New York office, and they were just kind of chit-chatting with me. And I had a moment where I like put my hands down on the table, and I was like, gentlemen, like if you have something to say to me, you should say it. And they were like, whoa, 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 what's going on here? And it's like, aren't you going to fire me today? And they're like, what are you talking about? Absolutely not. The company's doing great. You're doing a great job. You know, it turns out they were in New York. I think Ben was picking up his daughter from college, and Albert was just about to go on vacation for the holidays. And I was reading the book, so I had this narrative in my head. And but that weird moment that I had with them started this conversation of like, you know, them saying, do you not think you're doing a good job? Like, what's on your mind? And that's when I was like very open about, listen, I was the right person to run this company for, like, to get it to this stage. But if we really want to grow, this has to be a different type of person. And they disagreed initially. They're like, you're the person to lead this. And, you know, we had a good back and forth there, in which eventually we ended up putting in a plan to hire some additional help. This is when Jeff Glick, who's now our CEO, he came on board as our COO. And, you know, with this kind of idea for maybe this is the person that can, you know, kind of help us grow the business going forward. So that took 2 years to implement a plan from like me having a meeting with the board to, you know, actually putting another CEO in place. That's a 2 year
process. I feel like I should get some credit in the history books for that one.
Jeff
should give me some of his options.
you can bring that up with him. Yes.
So what is it like going from being the guy who starts a company who is the employee number one, goes through all these rounds of funding, all this craziness, all this media, the peak valuation of over $500 million, to then stepping down as CEO? What's it like that first day coming back to work when you're not the CEO?
It was weird because you have to, a lot of people do this and they become like chairman. And chairman means that like you have some role at the company, but you don't come to work anymore.
It's just a fancy title, right?
Yeah. And then, but there's chairman and there's executive chairman. And the difference is like the executive chairman comes to work because he still wants to be helpful and still feels like he can contribute. And that's, you know, I'm the executive chairman. I want to continue to help the company grow. But the, you know, my job now is to kind of get out of the way a little bit, which is hard. Like when you're used to running the, you know, running the show and answering all the questions and setting all of the agendas, it's hard to just do that and kind of sit on your hands.
So tell me the story of when you, the first day, I remember you mentioned this to me at some point. You walked to work and the first day you went into the office, you were like,
oh yeah, yeah, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Tell that story.
I can't remember what day we did the transition, but it must have been on a Tuesday or Wednesday or whatever. The next day, I was walking to the office, taking my normal path, and it just hit me that I was like, oh my God, like I'm not the CEO anymore. Like I don't have the stress and the pressure. And I like laughed like a madman on the street, just being like, I can't believe I did it. I got the company to this point, and I did the 2 year plan of transitioning, and I still have a role at the company where I get to do all the stuff that I want to do. And it just like kind of laughed out loud, and it like the type of laugh where you're kind of right at the edge of crying, not because it's so funny, but because like it's so emotional, and it's just a huge cathartic release. Like there was at the company meeting, the day before, we worked forever on the transition plan and all the media, and you know we announced a fundraising around the same time, and all the internal comms, and I remember getting up on stage, and I got to that slide, right? I had to look at the whatever 170 people that worked at Foursquare at the time and say, I'm not the one to lead the company anymore. I remember putting my hands out like this, like Jesus on a cross style, and just letting it all kind of like flow out. And it was just extremely cathartic.
Was it? Were you nervous before you did that? Was it a little
I was
terrifying?
Scared shitless. Yeah. You want to hear another great story?
Oh, we love stories.
I was so nervous that morning of like, should I do this? Should I not? Am I doing the right thing? Even though I had worked for 2 years trying to, you know, with my team, trying to get this transition plan in place and the fundraising, blah, blah, blah. And, you know, I was, you know, you're doubting yourself up to the last minute. Should I not do it? Should I do it? You know, obviously it's too late to go back. But my wife had left a calendar appointment. Like she had scheduled a calendar appointment. Like it's not a meeting. It's just like a note. And it was like the nicest note about like, you know, you're doing the right thing. I'm almost like tearing up thinking about this. You know, I'm so proud of you. You did all this stuff. Like you're absolutely doing the right thing. Jeff is the right guy. You've made the right decision. And it was like the moment, it was like the thing that I needed the most to see. And I saw it like when I went to work and I'm like, let me just check my calendar, make sure nothing's going on. And it was like this sweet note from Chelsea
amazing.
In there about like as a calendar entry about how I was doing the right thing. And that's what I needed to get through that day. I almost just got weepy on you, man.
No, you should you should totally cry. We need people to cry on this show more often. So you... Soon after this, you did something that caught me by surprise. So I, for listeners, during the World Cup, was it 2000? It was like, I mean,
it was one 2010. There was one 2014.
And it must have been the 2010. I was living in New York. You were living in New York, and we would go to all the bars and watch the World Cup.
Yeah, yeah,
and. And we got, there was a bunch of us that got really into soccer.
I forgot for a hot moment that you played on the hit team, Alphabet City.
I played on the Alphabet City team. I used to ride my Vespa down under the Brooklyn Bridge and play. I would always run out of breath before everyone else. But then next thing I know, you bought a soccer team.
Well, that next thing is like 8-10 years later.
Okay, but still, like, I mean, if you look at my corollary between us playing soccer in Alphabet City under the Brooklyn Bridge, and the next thing about soccer that I hear from you, other than a couple of tweets and animated GIFs, is you bought a soccer team. How did that happen?
Well, hold on. Didn't buy a team. We made a team from scratch.
Okay.
So we said, let's, you know, hey, wouldn't it be an awesome thing to build a club from scratch? Let's try to do that. It can't be any crazier than building like a tech company from scratch. And, you know, a big part of the motivation was, like, as a fan of the game, you think, like, the U.S., you know, is the U.S. ever going to win a World Cup in our lifetime? Like, how does an individual fan make soccer better in the U.S.? And
yeah.
One of the ideas was, like, why don't we make a club from scratch? And then as we make it from scratch, we'll teach other people how to make clubs in the hopes that more people will do it. And then there'll be more clubs, and then we can unify them, and we can make some awesome soccer systems.
But how do you go about making a soccer club? Could I start a soccer club?
Anyone can. So you should read my handy guides on my Medium page about it. No, I did a bunch of research.
Yeah.
There's a whole bunch of leagues in the lower level. Everyone knows about MLS, but there's a couple different levels in what's called the U.S. soccer pyramid. And, you know, we found a league called the NPSL that exists in what's, you know, what's referred to as Division IV. And there's some amazing clubs that are there. There's a club called Detroit City FC that has thousands of people coming to their matches in Detroit. A club called, you know, Chattanooga FC that's in Chattanooga, Tennessee, of all places, which is, you know, they have an amazing following there. And I'm looking at what these, you know, what these clubs have done for the community, for the fans, for the youth players, for the, you know, the players on the club, and saying, like, why don't we do one of these? We'll do it in the Hudson Valley. There's a lot of soccer fans up there, and they have to drive 2 hours to go to a match in New York City. Like,
what's the name of your soccer team?
A club is called Kingston Stockade FC.
And you're the owner?
Manager? I'm the chairman.
The chairman.
Yeah.
And how many, like, how do you get soccer players? Do you buy them? Like,
no, we held tryouts. Right?
And people showed up?
And not only did people show up, a lot of people showed up. And it was one of these things. I remember the very first try. It was like my friends from the city that came up. It's like, let's go. Can anyone play up here? Like, are we going to be able to put a functional team together? And we were at these tryouts, and, you know, what was it? Spring of 2016. And there was, you know, we were there for 5 minutes before. It's like, holy cow! Like, this is going to work, and this is going to work in a really good way. Like, there's just a lot of talent up there. A lot of guys that had been playing for a long time that had just never been seen. Like, this is, we're in the Hudson Valley. We're 2 hours north of New York City, and there's just not a lot of scouting that goes on up there.
And so do you have to, so you come up with the logos and the name?
Yep.
And and do you have to hire like a manager or?
Yeah, we hired a coach. I had a coach in 2000. We've played two seasons so far. We're about to start our third season. You know, we made a coaching change in between our first season and our second season. Our head coach now is this guy, David Lindholm, who's fantastic. He led our team to the conference championship
last year. Well, so that
was
it. So the thing that was so funny was you started the soccer team, and next thing I know, it's like it's like one of those crazy, like, Hollywood stories. They're like doing really well.
Yeah.
And they made it. Where did they go?
Well, we won there's about 100 teams in our league, and so we won our conference championship, which put us into the regionals, but then we got knocked out of the regionals. There's a lot of really talented teams in the Northeast, but hey, we made it far. Next year, we want to make it one round further. You know, there's a tournament in the U.S. called the U.S. Open Cup, in which, you know, all teams enter and get to compete against one another. So, you know, theoretically, if Stockade could qualify for the U.S. Open Cup, there's a chance that we could play a Division II, Division III, or maybe even an MLS team at some point. And so we set that as like one of the goals for our clubs. Let's make it a goal to qualify for this tournament within the first 5 years.
And and you have a huge number of fans now, right? And
it's huge for, like, we're in Kingston, New York, a town of, you know, about 19,000 people, And, you know, our attendance record is about 1,400 people showing up at a game. So there's not tens of thousands of people showing up, but, you know, during the season, like, Stockade is the biggest game in town.
That's awesome.
And the thing that is awesome about it, and this is totally, like, unexpected, was, you know, like, you put the team together, people come out, you're amazed by how many people are in the stands. But I remember after our very first match, and all the kids in the stands rushed the field, you know, I think our first match had 850 people, and it had to be 200 kids that rushed the field. And there's a fence that separates the, you know, the stands from the players. And all the kids wanted were the autographs to meet the players. And the guys who, you know, a lot of the guys who played in college, they're not used to signing autographs. They're like, well, what do we sign? What do we do? And I'm like, I guess we should figure out how to do this. And the captain, this guy Jamal, stood up and is like, no one goes inside until every kid gets everything signed. That's how we do this. Like, okay, let's find some pens. And but the story of the club, the thing that gets me so motivated and inspired is that, like, the kids love it. And the kids are like, all I want to do is play soccer. All I want to do is play for Stockade. All I want to do is play in high school now. Like, I talked to the local high school coach, and it's like, we have twice as many kids show up at tryouts now because they all want to play soccer. I keep thinking, if we, you know, my goal was to start this club from scratch, to get it to financially break even, to show people how we got it to financially break even and teach people how to do the clubs. And then, like, once you get to break even, you can run the club for forever. So if we keep the club going for 10 years, the kids that are in the stands now that are being inspired to play will play for our club in 10 years. And that's, like, that's my goal, is, like, keep that thing going and then to get people really riled up about it. It's, like, it is the most fun thing I've ever worked on.
Do you give, like, any kind of, like, Rudy-like speeches before the games, or?
I have tried. Coach is much better at him, and our captain, Jamal, is, like, this is his thing, right?
That's awesome.
And I've learned that my place is on the sidelines with the walkie-talkie, making sure everything runs smoothly, and I am just not involved with
I was going to say, if you had to do the Zuckerberg CEO thing, what kind of manager are you? You're the guy on the sidelines?
I'm the operations guy. I'm the guy that makes sure everything runs smoothly, and I've delegated all of, like, the, you know, technical development and scouting and coaching to a team of awesome guys.
So, okay, so we're going to kind of wind down here, and I'm very happy that this that we're kind of going, we've had all these high notes, because usually the show is, like, by the end of it, it's AI is going to kill us, you know, the sixth extinction is going to happen, North Korea, Donald Trump, like, you know.
Oh, I got all the fluff questions.
You got all the fluff questions. No, this is all, it's fascinating to hear how this stuff all actually happens. But I'm going to go back and ask you a couple more questions about, you know, the last, what, has it been 15 years running these companies? And
yeah, what year is it now? 2018. So 2000. let's go back 18 years. Let's go 2000.
18 years. What are some of the what's like the hardest thing you ever had to do?
The hardest thing I ever had to do. One of the hardest moments I've ever had was the moment that we talked about with, like, the decision to do the Facebook or Yahoo deal or to keep going with the company. That is one of the hardest things. But it's specific one moments. But the hardest thing is to convince yourself that the next idea that you have is worth doing. I hope I do an okay job articulating this. Like, to take Dodgeball from a silly little side project to a thesis project to a company to selling it, like, there's so many moments there where you're like, I have absolutely no business doing this. I'm so over my head. I'm not the right guy for this. Someone else should do this. And you just make it work, right? And we started Foursquare, and we got 30 no's from, like, the top VCs in the country. You're like, maybe this isn't for me. Maybe I'm not the person to do this. Maybe someone else. Maybe I suck at this. And you just have to forge through. Like, when we had the idea to do the soccer team, it's like, I'm not the right person to do this. Like, I suck at playing. I'm not even any good. But and just the idea of, like, I'm a tech guy. I shouldn't be doing this. I'm not qualified to do this. But then you just do it, and it works. And I, this this that that doubt plagues me all the time. Like, there's things at Foursquare that I still want to do that we haven't built yet with the data and technology where I'm like, maybe this isn't our thing to do. Maybe we're not the company to do this. Maybe I shouldn't do this. Maybe someone else should do this. And then sometimes you just have to put your foot down and be like, you know what? Like, fuck it. We are going to be the ones that do this. And I will be the one that makes this thing. And I will put the team together that does it. And I think there's like a real thing to be said for like believing in yourself and your own ability to do it, regardless of, like, I felt this way before I had done anything. And I felt this way after I sold Dodgeball. And I felt this way, you know, in the middle of the Foursquare hype. And I feel this way even having like a really successful Division IV soccer team. Like, the next thing is too hard. It's too impossible. It's not worth doing. Everyone's going to laugh at you. You know, I have that. I have.
But how do you overcome it?
You just have to have that. Like, who cares? I'm gonna do it anyway. Because if I don't do it, no one else is gonna do it. And if no one else does it, it will never get built. And the world will be better if we do this thing. And sometimes you just have to like tell yourself to shut up and just do it. And that has been a really hard thing for me to like learn, get over.
So what's next?
I don't know. You know,
I mean,
like,
are you done? Are you gonna eventually, like, is this the last tech company you start?
Well, this one's not over yet, you know, like my title's still executive chairman. Like, I have a desk and a role.
You don't have a desk, yeah. And, so you're sitting in the cafeteria when I showed up.
Yeah. Well, I like to know that. Yeah. But I have an agenda of things I want to still do at Foursquare, and I want to get all those things done. You know, there's not a ton of, to be honest, there's not a lot of ton of stuff that's going on in the tech space outside of what we work on at Foursquare that really excites me. Like, I don't have like some other startup that I'm itching to build. You know, like I do a lot of like on the ground in real life community development with the Stockade Soccer Project, and that makes me very satisfied and fulfilled. And then, you know, I'm working on trying to spin up this R&D lab at Foursquare that will just make crazy stuff for the sake of making crazy stuff, because I feel like that's what the company should do. Like, I feel like I should, like, there's a role at Foursquare for the grad student that was at ITP, you know, 15 years ago. And we need to have room to do that type of wild innovation, because that's the stuff that eventually ends up inventing the future.
Why is it that, two questions before we wrap up, why is it that there's nothing I really see happening in Silicon Valley these days that really overly excites me? I mean, driverless cars are very cool, and I can't wait for that to happen. They're going to save lives, and I want my own pet robot one day. But, you know, I look at a lot of the technology innovation, if you'll want to call it that, that's happening, like, and some of it's just ridiculous, you know, Juicero and blah blah blah. Like, are we in a lull right now because technology is not at the place? It's almost like the ideas, do the ideas suck, or is the technology incapable of actually creating the ideas that we have today? And
no,
that's why
I think we're just kind of at a plateau right now. You know, just to correct my earlier statement about like not being inspired by technology, it's mostly like consumer technology, stuff that people use in the streets.
Yeah.
And I think the plateau is like, you know, the phones are kind of plateaued, right? Like the social networks have plateaued. There's nothing new yet. Like, remember, the moment that Steve Jobs held the iPhone 1 up and he swiped his finger across the glass and it worked, it's like, holy cow, that's new. That's new and that's different. You know, the moment that you could see the blue dot flashing on the, you know, Google map for the first time, like, this phone knows where I am. That's new. That's different. We haven't had a lot of, like, that's new, that's different in a long time. And I think about this stuff a lot, right? I think, like, what is the next technology innovation? It's got to be something that gets us away from, like, we're all walking down the street looking down at our phones. Like, that is absolutely not the way that, like, the world can evolve, right? It'll be something else. Does that mean that it's, like, a bot that whispers to you through your Apple AirPods? Does that mean that it's, you know, some augmented reality display that you wear or you put in through like a contact lens? Like, this stuff seems like science fiction right now, but like that is the science fiction that someone will stand up on stage at a keynote and show us, in the same way that, you know, Steve Jobs swiped his finger across the glass, and that's the thing that will change and I think re-spark a whole bunch of innovation. But it's just like, that stuff doesn't exist yet. Like, we're in a lull.
All right, so last question. If I came to you right now and I said, hey, the board has told me that you have to leave. Today's your last day at Foursquare. And the power to build these technologies you just mentioned exists or will exist. What would be the dream thing that you would make?
I'm really interested in this idea of we're all alone together, or the idea of like familiar strangers, right? There's all these devices, all these people around us, and they're generating all these data points. And a lot of times we never get to interact with those people or meet those people or kind of get a sense of what those data points mean. And so I really like the idea of trying to take all the data that Foursquare has and visualize it in some sense. So you get a sense of like how the city is living and breathing and moving and what the masses of people are doing at once. I haven't really seen, besides for internal things, I haven't seen a lot of those data visualizations. You know, I really like the idea of, another smart services that are trying to tell you about okay, there's something around the corner that you missed, or you just walked by someone that you need to interact with. I like the idea of games that use all of the phones around us as non-playing characters. You know,
what do you mean by that?
When you play you play World of Warcraft or yeah. something, there's a bunch of human people you interact with, but then there's a whole bunch of robot AI characters. Could you use real data of where people are to generate those types of characters? Is there some, gaming element that's built on top of that? Can you build apps and games that change depending on where you've been or where you're going or where you're standing right now? You know, there's this whole era of contextual aware computing that we're right in the moment where it's about to start happening. It just hasn't started happening yet. And I think Foursquare pushes a lot of that stuff going forward. But I think people have to invent those apps and use cases and experiences so that other people can see them and learn from them and be inspired by them. And that's kind of the stuff I want to do at Foursquare. Outside of technology, I don't know. To go back to your earlier question, is there a moment where you ever just not do anything? The idea of not working on something and not having a project, it scares the crap out of me. I have to have something to be tinkering with all the time. Otherwise I go kind of crazy. And I feel fortunate to have, a big chunk of that with Foursquare and a little chunk of that with the Stockade Soccer stuff. And, if one or two of those things went away, we'd have to find something else.
Well, that is a perfect place to end this. Thank you so much, Dennis, for taking the time. Where can people follow the Stockade Football Club?
So the club is called Stockade FC. It's stockadefc.com or at Stockade.
And if they want to start their own soccer team, because I'm thinking about it right now, I'm thinking maybe 2-year-old toddler soccer, start off small.
Hey, listen, start developing the players, start moving the players through the system. I wrote this... every season, beginning and end of the season, I write a big Medium post about how we did it, how much it cost, how much it's going to cost you, what the attendance is, what the data is. It's we call it open source soccer, right? And we share it with everyone, and it's been really, I think, good for the sport. You can go to medium.com/StockadeFC.
You lost them. Just Google it.
just Google it. Google startup soccer and you'll find it.
All right, cool. Well, thank you very much, Dennis. This has been fantastic.
Hey, thanks for having me
of course,
on the
show. I'm going to come try out for your soccer club.
We'd love to have you. That would be great comic relief.
This is Inside the Hive with Nick Bilton.
Hey, welcome back, Nick. That was a great interview. I'm curious, listening to it now, what do you think is the biggest difference between our current moment and the sort of, entrepreneurial moment in which Crowley was founding Foursquare?
I think it's a great question, and I think it's also a question that I've thought about not just as in the current moment and in the moment that Crowley was founding Foursquare, which was not too long ago, just a few years ago, but... What I also find fascinating is the, Dennis is a good guy. He's a legitimately good guy. And there are so few of those in Silicon Valley. There are so many people who are jerks and not nice and not thoughtful about their company and their employees and so on. And I recently asked someone who's been covering this industry for a long time, what makes, is it that when you look at people like Dennis and, you know, Aaron Levy and folks like that, they're the small handful of good people and most of them are jerks. Why is it that so many of them are? And were people like Jeff Bezos and Bill Gates and Steve Jobs equal jerks back when they were young entrepreneurs starting out in their company? And the response I heard is that no, they weren't. Like they could be ruthless and they could do things that were, you know, unkind to competitors and even to their employees. But there's a kind of a different mentality of entrepreneurs today that really makes them into kind of thoughtless, you know, I have to win at all costs kind of people. And it's a shame that there are not more Dennises out there.
Is it as simple, excuse me, as the fact that now everyone knows just how extraordinary the money could be?
Oh, I think so. I think that back in the day, you know, the money was big, the money was huge, you know, when Microsoft and all those companies, I mean, you know, a lot of back then it was all computer chips and things like that. And I think that now when you look at how rich these people are, I mean, it's just astounding. I mean, Amazon, I mean, Jeff Bezos, $107 billion, Zuckerberg, you know, like half that. Bill Gates is giving his money away billions and billions of dollars a year, and he's making more money on the investments that he has with the money he hasn't given away yet. He literally is getting richer the more he gives away. And I think that and then you kind of see this culture of people that that just are selfish and just want to be richer, and we kind of, that's the world we live in today.
Well, gee.
Anyway, yes, on that happy note. Well, I do think that there are lots of good people in Silicon Valley that are working hard on projects. The ones that we don't necessarily know about are the ones that we don't hear about because they kind of have their heads down and just getting the shit done. So, anyway, let's go out on a. Would you like to do the thank you this week, or should I?
Oh, Nick, you're so good at it. Go ahead.
All right. Well, thanks to my guest, Dennis Crowley, and of course to you, John Kelly. Virtual hugs. If you enjoyed this conversation, be sure to listen and subscribe to other great episodes of Inside the Hive with Nick Bilton. You can find these on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, or anywhere you get your podcasts. And don't forget to leave a review while you're there. I just want to take a side note, John. People don't leave reviews unless they're like pissed off. You should just take 2 seconds and just go and say, you know what? I actually like this podcast.
Yeah, come on, everyone. If you like what you're listening to, leave a nice review.
If you've listened this far, you need to leave a review or go tell me to go to hell on Twitter. Anyway, thanks to the folks at Cadence 13 for their production work. Thanks to my editors at Vanity Fair. And thanks, of course, to our sponsor, Goop. Please support them the same way you support this podcast. John, I will see you next week.
Adios, Nick.
I'm Alex Schwartz.
I'm Nomi Fry.
I'm Vincent Cunningham, and this is Critics at Large, a New Yorker podcast for the culturally curious.
Each week, we're going to talk about a big idea that's showing up across the cultural landscape, and we'll trace it through all the mediums we love: books, movies, television, music, art.
And I always want to talk about celebrity gossip, too.
Of course.
What are you guys excited to cover in the next few months?
There's a new translation of the Iliad that's coming out, Emily Wilson. Oh. Really excited to see whether I can read the Iliad again, whether I'm that literate. I mean, the jury is out.
I can't wait to hear Adam Driver go again in an Italian accent in Michael Mann's Ferrari.
He can't stop.
I mean, and bless him. I can't wait.
Molto bene.
Molto bene.
We hope you'll join us for new episodes each Thursday. Follow Critics at Large today, wherever you get podcasts.
You really don't want to miss this.
Don't.
Don't miss this.
Don't miss it.
See you soon.